Let me just review a moment. I think that keeps a thing before us better. Now, remember that ambush was from down here to court. It's down around here to court about here. Here's Jerusalem up about here. And here's Bethel about here. About 12 miles from here to Jerusalem, about 12 miles up to Bethel. So it was just about 25 miles. And yet that was a long way for Amos, because he, herdsman, out-of-doors man, probably hadn't been up in that country much. But I got to thinking when I was studying this lesson, well, that isn't as far as it is from here down to our house, down to just about 29 miles from here to the house. And that was about 25.
Well, Amos didn't have a car,
though,
did he?
No, I guess he didn't. He didn't have a bicycle, did he? Because he had to walk there, that's right. At any rate, God sent him up there to prophesy against these people here, but especially Israel. Now, he began over here with Damascus. Started with Damascus. And you'll notice I pointed out last time, he took the three people of the three nations that were not kin to the Jews. From Damascus down here to Phoenicia, and from Phoenicia, Philistia, up here to Phoenicia. And he got those three. And then he comes down here to Edom, and then from Edom up here to Ammon, and from Ammon down here to Moab. Those are the six that he prophesied against. Then the seventh, the one we're looking at now, he now turns to Jerusalem and Judah. And then from Judah up here to Israel, comes up here to them. So he's kind of going around about way to get to them, but he eventually gets to the ones that he came up there to prophesy against. Well, let's begin now and remember that all of these six, the six that we studied last Sunday, their judgments were primarily because of cruelty, because of social injustice, because of mistreatment of individuals and no concept of human life, the value of human life. Now, when it comes to Judah, it's an entirely different sin. This is the sin of apostasy. Begin with verse 4, thus saith Jehovah, the three transgressions of Judah, yea, for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have rejected the law of Jehovah, and have not kept his statutes, and their lies have caused them to err, after which their fathers did walk. But I will send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem. Now, these lies are the lies of false teachers who were leading them into idolatry. They spoke oftentimes of those idols as being lies. Back here in the ninth chapter of the book of Isaiah, verse 15 and 16, if you want to turn to it, here it says, the elder and the honorable man, he is the head, and the prophet that teacheth lies, he is the tail. For they that lead this people are called them to err, and they that are led are of them that are destroyed. Right? They taught them lies. We turn over to Habakkuk, second chapter. You have the same thing there, the second chapter in verse 18 of Habakkuk. And notice what it says here, 2:18 here. What profiteth the graven image, that the maker thereof hath graven it? The molten image, even the teacher of lies, that he that fashioneth its form trusteth therein to make dumb idols. Going on, woe unto them, he says, that worship the dumb idol. So here the individual who made the idol was making a lie. Here's a god. Here's no god. And the individual that teaches the dumb idol is god is lies. So the lie that Judah listened to of the lies were the lies of those false prophets and the lies of those who turned to idolatry and led the people into idolatry. All right, they were religious lies. And so it is today, we're subject to the political lies and religious lies all about us. We know that. But at any rate, now that's their condemnation. It's because of apostasy, leaving Jehovah and turning to idols and listening to the false teachers, the liars, who led them in that direction. Right? Now the next one, now he comes to Israel. As I said last Sunday, I think you can see him when he's talking about those nations, oh, that's fine. Amen, Brother Amos. Preach on. He gets to Judah, you're getting a little too close. I suspect they're getting pretty quiet now. Now when he gets to Israel, while they are quiet, if they listen to him for a while at least, and thus saith Jehovah, the three transgressions of Israel, yea, for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have sold the righteous for silver, and the needy for a pair of shoes. A low estimate of human life. In fact, disdaining human life. Selling an individual for something like this. They that pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor and turn aside the way of the meek. Right now, in the different interpretations of that, I think the idea is it's just a sarcastic statement of the prophet. In sarcasm, yes, you're even so covetous that you begrudge an individual dust on his head. When in his worry or in his condition, he would cast dust up in the air as an expression of it, and you even don't like that. I mean, you even pant after that. In other words, you wash their hair and drain the water to get the dust out of it. That's just an extreme idea. Of course, they didn't do that, but they panted after it. Right? And the way of the meek. Now, the meek was the submissive individual, but now then, you do not give the meek justice. You take justice away from him. And a man and his father go under the same maiden, that is the religious prostitutes. Now, those false religions, those idolatrous religions, they had women who were dedicated to the prostitution of those gods, known as the fertility cults. It was an idea of encouraging the god to give them good crops and good and large families and all that. Well, of course, that's, and a man and his own son to turn aside under the same maiden, profaning the religion of God, to profane my holy name. The idea of doing a thing like that. Well, you remember back in 1 Kings 12, when Jeroboam the first became king over Israel after the division of the kingdom there, and Rehoboam to the south and Jeroboam to the north, he set up an altar, an image rather, at Bethel and another one at Dan. Now this one at Bethel, actually they worshipped Jehovah all right, but it was through this false system. Now then, when Ahab and Jezebel came along, they set up Baal worship as a national religion. So you have two systems of false religion in Israel. You have Baal worship, which is pure paganism. You have the calf worship, which is a perverted form of Jehovah worship, with their own days and their own rite and their own priesthood, but they still claim to worship Jehovah through that which was false and God didn't accept it. So now then, here is your false religion. And they lay themselves down beside every altar upon clothes taken in pledge. All right, now let me look at that for just a moment. Back in Exodus, the 22nd chapter, you have the law that God gave regulating that. In the 22nd chapter, down about verse 26. And if thou at all take thy neighbor's garment to pledge, thou shalt restore it unto him before the sun goeth down. For that is his only covering. It is his garment for his skin, wherein shall he sleep. And it shall come to pass, when he crieth unto me, that I will hear, for I am gracious. Right? So if you took a man's garment in pledge for that he's going to do something or pay you something, you've got to give it back to him before night, so he'll have something to cover himself with that night. Well, that's what he's talking about there. So they do all that. Now here's another thing they do. And in the house of their God, they drink the wine of such as have been fined. Fine an individual, then either or fine him so much wine, or fine him for money and buy wine, and celebrate that in the house of your God. So now, when it comes to Israel, Israel was both indifferent to human life, and also was worshiping a false god, a false religion. So they completely apostatized, Israel has. Now there was still hope for Judah, because at the same time that Amos and Hosea were prophesying in Israel, about that time, a little bit later, Isaiah and Micah were prophesying in Judah. Now, Isaiah and Micah, along with a good king, they had a good king, Hezekiah, and the northern never did have a good king. On the whole 200 years of their history, they never had a king who was faithful to Jehovah. Judah had several. So through the influence of Isaiah and Micah and good King Hezekiah, they were able to turn enough of the people in the south back to God. God spared Judah for another 135 years. But Amos and Hosea were unable to turn the people of Israel back, so they went into captivity in 722. We'll come to that a little later. Right? So now then, that's the condition now in Judah and Israel, and the prophecy against all of these nations. Right? And you'll notice then that Israel is worse than ever, all of them, because it was both false religion and that man and his wife going to the same maiden, religious prostitutes there, and attitude toward human life and human nature and all of that. Right? Now God turns again. Yet God says, now this is what you've done. Yet I destroyed the Amorite before them. Now here God telling what I've done. Now this land, I gave you this land. If I gave it to you, I can take you out of it. That is mine. I can remove you from it. Because I gave it to you. You were down in Egypt as slaves. I brought you out. I brought you into this land. I gave you the land of the Amorites. Now the word Amorite means westerner. And so they looked upon this land of Canaan, this people of Canaan, as Amorites, or westerners. Because it was right on the border of the Mediterranean Sea. Couldn't go any farther west than that. At least if you were coming in from the Arabian Desert. Right? So it moves on now. Yet I destroyed the Amorite from before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and he was strong as the oaks. Now, of course, that's just a figure of speech, indicating the strength of these men. And you remember that when the 12 spies came back, 10 of them said, "Well, we were as grasshoppers in their sight, big folk, bigger than we are." Yet I destroyed his fruit from above and his root from beneath. Back under when God said to Abraham, rather, he wasn't yet able to give the land to the descendant of Abraham yet, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. God never destroyed a nation or a people until the cup of their iniquity was full. As long as there was hope of their turning to righteousness, God never destroyed them. When a nation reaches a point of no return, then God's judgment is executed. Have we reached the point of no return or not? I wouldn't answer that one. I don't know. Also, I brought you up out of the land of Egypt and led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. And I raised up of your sons for prophets and of your young men for Nazarites. Is it not even thus, O ye children of Israel, said Jehovah? But you gave the Nazarites wine to drink and commanded the prophets, saying, prophesy not. Now the prophet was an inspired man from God to teach the people and to try to turn them back to God. And back in the 6th chapter of Numbers, if you want to turn to it, let's look at this Nazarite for just a moment. The Nazarite was a particular holy person. It meant a separated person, one set apart. They were holy people a Nazarite vow was one that you could take or not take. It was not obligatory at all. Returning back to the 6th chapter of Numbers, and Jehovah spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when either man or woman shall make a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, that means a separated one who is separated. Right? Now you'll notice that a woman could take this vow also. I imagine that Hannah took that vow. You remember when she was praying before Eli, the prophet, the priest. He thought she was drunk. She said, no, thy handmaid is not drunk. But I'm praying for a son. I don't want to give him to Jehovah. Well, she practically made a vow there, and not called a Nazarite vow, but it came under the head of one who sets himself apart to do a thing. Right? So probably that was, she took that vow. I don't know, but I'm suggesting it. At any rate, now to separate himself unto Jehovah. Now here's what he does. Man or woman makes a special vow. The vow of the night to separate himself unto Jehovah. He shall separate himself. I know he drink no wine, strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink. Neither shall he drink any juice of grapes, nor eat fresh grapes or dried, that is raisins. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the grapevine, from the kernels even to the husk. Now, I never have understood why, since that he made it prohibitive to eat the grape juice, because that is used as a food and so highly praised in the Old Testament. Unless it was this. Maybe it was simply an indication of your separating yourself from the luxuries of Palestine. For the grapes was one of their great products there, and wine and all of that. So it might be that it's simply a symbol of separation, that I'll not partake of that which is universally used and which is one of the blessings that are ours dwelling here in this country, in this Palestine or in Canaan here. So unless that was it, I don't know why he selected the grape at all. Of course, we know that Jesus selected for his supper and took the fruit of the vine there, and we know that, and we know that it's encouraged in the Old Testament, and that wine the growth of the vine is. And that's always an expression of that prosperity and plenty. We find later on that Moab especially finds vineyards down there. Well, all right. Then he goes on to say, all the days of his vow of separation, there shall no razor come upon his head. When the days be fulfilled in which he separated himself unto Jehovah, he shall be holy. He shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow long. Now, probably, and I think it is said that Samson was a Nazarite from his birth. God said he shouldn't cut his hair. He was not to partake of these things either. So I think he was a Nazarite from his birth. Samuel possibly was. But you have a number of individuals back there who were Nazarites. But in Ecclesiastes, the 5th chapter, in the first 2 or 3 verses, whosoever voweth a vow unto Jehovah, let him defer not to pay it. For Jehovah had no pleasure in breaking the vow, lying there. So if a man vowed a vow, God expected him to pay it. Now notice further, not only was he to refrain from grape juice and anything of the grape, was not to cut his hair, there's a third thing. All the days that he separated himself unto Jehovah, he shall not come near to a dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother, for his brother or for his sister, when they die, because his separation unto God is upon his head. Now death, you remember, is a consequence of sin. And so this man separated himself unto God, but even to separate himself from his mother or father died. He was not to touch them. All the days of his separation he is holy unto Jehovah. And if any man die very suddenly beside him, and he defile the head of his separation, then he shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing. On the 7th day shall he shave it. And on the 8th day he shall bring the 2 turtle doves and so on. It goes on down to say here that he's going to cut his hair and start over. Now those days that he's already been a Nazarite don't count. Because now if I took a vow for, say, 6 weeks, now that on at the end of the 4th week, here's a person dies right near me, and I touch it or come in contact with it close enough to it, then I'm crammed unclean. Then I've got to shave over my head and start over again and go back to and start the 6 weeks over. Those 4 weeks don't count. Get that down as you go on and read it down there. But it's interesting anyway. 13, for this is the law of the Nazarite, when the days of his separation are fulfilled. For here's the sacrifice that he was to make there. Then he could drink wine after that. He said he can go back and drink wine. All right, now here's the point. You've taken these people who separated themselves unto God and was specially serving God in some way. You made them to drink wine. You caused them to defile and violate their promise, their oath, their vow there. All right, so, and the prophets that I raised up to prophesy, you said don't prophesy. Don't prophesy from God, but prophesy lies unto us. You really want the difference between I think it's over here that Micah. Micah is the one that really shows the difference between the true prophet and the false prophet in the 32nd chapter, verse 11. Now notice here in chapter 2, Micah 2:11, if a man walking in a spirit of falsehood do lie, saying, I will prophesy unto thee of wine and a strong drink, he shall even be the prophet of this people. Now here, this is a fellow who prophesies what they want to hear. They want somebody to prophesy of good crops and good vineyards and a full wine vat and all that. To have all that, drink strong drink, he'll even be your prophet. You take him. But I look over here at the 3rd chapter, verse 8. But as for me, I am full of power by the Spirit of Jehovah, and of judgment and of might, to declare unto Jacob his transgression, and to Israel his sin. That's the 3rd chapter, verse 8. So in chapter 2, verse 11, chapter 3, verse 8, you have the contrast between the false prophet and the true prophet. The false prophet prophesies what the people want to hear. True prophet prophesies and condemns their sins, which they don't want to hear. And so that's the difference between the two, to declare unto Jacob his transgression and unto Israel his sin. I think it's not enough, class, for an individual simply to teach truth, to tell people what the Bible says is truth. I think if that individual refrains from telling them what their sins are and condemning those sins, he is as much a false prophet or false teacher as the individual that teaches something that isn't true. Because a man who carries out God's will tells people what their sin is. And that's what Micah said, I'm doing. All right, so there's a difference between the two. but you tell these prophets, saying, prophesy not. Now God says, and this is a rather difficult figure here, behold, I will press you in your place as a cart presses that is full of sheaves, and flight shall perish from the swift, and the strong shall not strengthen his force, neither shall the mighty deliver himself, neither shall he stand that handleth the bow, and he that is swift of foot shall not deliver himself, neither shall he that rideth the horse deliver himself, and he that is courageous among the mighty shall flee away naked in that day, saith Jehovah. Now notice he says back, here's a cart pressing. Now here's a cart. Right? You filled it full of sheaves and press them down, pushing out the sides. Right? I think this means more than a few things. Either that God will bring these enemy against you here, where you're pressed in and can't get away. Or it means that as this army rolls in here with its army equipment, it'll press you underfoot as a full cart would press whatever it rolled over there. But either one of them, it signifies in some way for how it will be when God brings this judgment against them. If either be, I'll press you in here, you can't get away, the swift man can't run, and the horseman can't get out. You're pressed in from all sides here. As a cart is full of sheaves, is pressed in by the sides of it. Or it means here, I'll roll these carts over you, the machines of war here, they'll roll you over you, and you won't be able to escape. Either one, you're just not able to get away. That's the whole deal there. When that judgment comes. All right, now that's chapter 2. That's the introduction. That's the introduction. Now the rest of this is built on what he has said here of their sins and of their apostasy, things of that nature, the wickedness. All right. Now he cries out, hear this word that Jehovah has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family. Now it's against both Judah and against Israel. It's against both of them. I want you to notice something else. Hear this word that Jehovah has spoken against you. It isn't I who am speaking. Now you remember that we pointed out several times since I've been teaching out here what a prophet is. Go back to Exodus, the 3rd chapter, verse 16. Moses said, I'm not an eloquent speaker. Because Aaron's your eloquent speaker. Aaron then shall be your mouth. Now notice that. I believe that's the 3rd chapter, verse 16, if I remember correctly. Aaron shall be thy mouth. All right? Might have been the 4th chapter. Now notice he says here, and thou shalt speak unto him, that is to Aaron, put the words in his mouth, and I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what you shall do. And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and it shall come to pass that he shall be to thee a mouth, and thou shalt be to him as God. Right? Aaron then is to be your mouth, and you are to be to him as God. Now look at the 7th chapter and verse 1. And Jehovah said unto Moses, see, I have made thee as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron thy brother shall be thy prophet. But in one place he's thy mouth. In the next he's thy prophet. Now in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 18 and 19, God shall raise him up a prophet from among their brethren like unto thee. And I will put my words in his mouth. And all things whatsoever I shall command thee shall he speak. Right? So the prophet was God's mouth. God was speaking through him. Those two passages, I think that's the best definition you'll ever find of what a prophet is. He's a mouth of God. God speaking through him. That's in Exodus 4:16, 7:1. All right, so hear this word that Jehovah has spoken against you, O children of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up. Not just Judah, not just Israel, but the whole family. So what he's saying is against all of them, the whole family, which I brought up out of the land of Egypt, saying, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will visit upon you all your iniquities. Now remember, all the families of the earth God chose the descendants of Abraham. They were carried down into Egypt. God selected them as a nation and brought them out. Now here's a third point, class, that I think we'll always remember. That when we have benefits or blessings, special favors, that always brings special responsibilities. Our special relation to God as redeemed people by the blood of Christ, puts upon us special responsibilities. We stand different from the world. We're different from the world. We're called out of the world into fellowship with our blessings, our good things from God, our relationship to Him, lays upon us special obligations. Can't get away from it. Do you leave God? Right? I'll visit upon you all your iniquities. Now here's the point. Shall two walk together except they have agreed? I'm up here as a God spokesman. So it applies to both Amos and the people. Now I can't walk with God unless I'm in agreement with God. God's called me now to preach to you, and I'm going to preach to you what God tells me to preach. But that will also apply to you. You can't walk with God unless you're in agreement with Him. Now, the only way I can walk with God and maintain my walk with Him in agreement is to do what He tells me to do. He sent me up here to preach to you. I'm going to preach to you. Because I'm going to walk with God. Now, if you want to walk with Him, you've got to be in agreement with Him also. So shall two walk together except to be agreed? No. That's the point of the negative concept. All right, now here's another question. Will a lion roar in the forest when he hath no prey? I've read, and I don't know much about this, but I've read that the lion stalks its prey, and just before it springs upon it, it roars. Now, I don't know if that's so or not. And the younger lions, when the prey is brought in, they roar when they see it. But at any rate, the lion roars over its prey. Shall it roar when it hears no prey? He asked him. Well, this was a figure from his life as a shepherd, out of doors among the lions and the beasts of the field. Well, he has a third question. Will a young lion cry out of his den? He hath taken nothing. He got nothing to cry about. Here's a third. Now here comes another. Now that, I think, has reference to his preaching and his teaching. Now this next is reference to them. Now notice it. Can a bird fall into a snare from the earth where no gin is set for him? Now the people have set the trap for themselves. Their sins have become the trap. And now have them entrapped, have them in his power. So now, and the question is here, can a bird fall in a snare upon the earth where no chin is set for it? Well, no, got to be a snare there. So can you fall into a trap if there's no trap there? Well, there is a trap, and you set the trap. Your sins are the trap that have caught you. Shall a snare spring up from the ground and have taken nothing at all? And can't you see Amos calling upon his experiences here? Why, no doubt he'd set traps for the birds and snares for them, get something to eat. He'd heard the lions roar. He was acquainted with the young lions. All of these are figures from his background, his own what we call today lifestyle. We always talk about both lifestyle and lifestyle. I kind of despise the term personally, but I guess it's pretty expressive. I don't like it myself, but it is expressive, and it's one we use here, the lifestyle. Well, they're talking about Amos' lifestyle. He's out there in the open there. He was acquainted with the lions, he was acquainted with the bears, he was acquainted with the snakes, acquainted with all those things, acquainted with the birds and how to catch them. He wanted something to eat, he had to know how to do that. All right? Now comes another point. Now you're going to make an application. Shall the trumpet be blown in a city and the people not be afraid? Shall evil befall a city and Jehovah have not done it? All right? Shall the trumpet sound? Now, back when we were studying a little book of Joel, we had a trumpet. Well, I believe I turned to this at that time. I turned to Numbers 10, didn't I? I didn't notice it just a moment. I won't try to read the whole thing here. But in Numbers 10, you have the use here of the trumpets among them. They have the trumpets here. I notice they call the congregation to continue on the journey. Verse 5, when you blow an alarm, the camps around the east shall go. Verse 7, when the assembly is to be gathered together, you blow. That's a different sound. Verse 9, when you go to war in your land against the adversary that oppresses you, even you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets here. And in verse 10, the day of your gladness. So these trumpets sounded the introduction of a festival, or it's time to start moving, or it's time to stop in camp, or it's time to get ready for war. Well, that's what Paul meant when he said if the trumpets sound with an uncertain sound, will a person know what to do about it, whether to retreat or whether to advance? Shall we charge or shall we retreat? So the trumpeter has to sound the right note, or the right sound, for us to know what to do. So it is here then. Right? So now then, the trumpet is to be blown in a city and the people be not afraid. That is an alarm, the trumpet of an alarm there. And they'll call them to prepare, get ready. Now when evil befalls the city, and Jehovah does it. Now class, we often think of evil as wickedness or that. No, the evil he's talking about, the evil of judgment. The evil of a judgment. When we've sinned, sin comes, here's a judgment before the city. It's the evil of judgment that he's talking about. Yeah, not wickedness. The wickedness already happened. Now it's coming, the evil of the judgment of destruction that falls upon the people. This is what he has in mind with this. I think we ought to know that there. You find that lots of time, number of times in the Old Testament, where here the evil befalls the city, and Jehovah does it, brings evil upon it. It's the evil of judgment, destruction. Well, all right. Now he says, now know what is next. His servant the prophets, befall the city, and Jehovah not done it? Surely. The Lord Jehovah will do nothing except he reveal his secret unto his servants, the prophets. And that expression, his servants, the prophets, that occurs a good many times. Here, I have a book written by an outstanding scholar. He called it My Servants, the Prophets. An excellent little book. And he got it from this, right? Right now, here then, he would do nothing except reveal it to his servants, the prophets. All right? Now you say, how about today? Why, God's revealed it to us in his prophets. That's what I've been trying to do all this time in studying his prophets, is to show God's judgment against a nation when that nation departs from righteousness and becomes absolutely wicked. God revealed that in his prophets. Well, he's saying he didn't send us a prophet. No, no. But what he revealed in those prophets who spoke from God is a message to all mankind for all time under similar circumstances. So what God is warning back there through his prophets is a message to us today if we don't listen to it. There's no reason why we shouldn't, except we don't want to. Our nation doesn't want to listen, doesn't want to hear it. Rather listen to the lies of the politicians or religious liars who prophesy that Jesus is going to come back and set up his kingdom. So be sure you're in favor with those Jews over there, so you'll be favoring the Lord when he gets back. I think that's been an idea the last two or three decades here, this Zionistic movement there. Why should we be so favorable toward the Jews all the time and all that? I'm persuaded deep down it's because our Congress and our rulers don't much believe the Bible, but yet the Jews still stand as a monument to the fact that God has spoken. They think of them as God's chosen people. So when the Messiah comes and sets up his kingdom, we want to be on good terms with them. I don't want to be on good terms. I want to be on terms with them from the gospel and no other terms. And there's all a lot of false. And now God's told us through his prophets. Right, so the point is then, his servant the prophet, the lion hath roared, who will not fear? If the lion roars when he got his prey, then the lion has roared. That's Jehovah now, speaking for a roar from Zion. Right, if that's so, who's the prey? Judah and Israel. Yeah, he won't roar unless he has some prey there. And the lion has roared, so he's ready to pounce. So that confirms the idea that he roars just before he jumps on his prey there, but I haven't seen that in any television of those animals there. And now look, the Lord Jehovah has spoken. Who can but prophesy? If God has spoken, who can but prophesy? He tell people what he has said. All right, now this Amos is here declaring his right to speak. Why have you come up here from Tekoa to preach to us people up here? Because the whole both nations are Israel. And I'm condemning Judah just as well as I'm condemning you. God has spoken. I can't help but prophesy. The lion has roared. The prey had better get out of the way. Or he's ready to pounce. Ready to pounce. And that's vivid, isn't it? Very vivid. Published here in the palaces of Ashdod. Now Ashdod was this one of these cities down here in Philistia there. There were four of them. You remember last Sunday. Five, Gath, had probably been destroyed. It wasn't mentioned. All right, now tell it. Now know tell it there. Publish ye in the palaces at Ashdod, and in the palaces in the land of Egypt, and say, assemble yourselves upon the mountains of Samaria, and behold what great tumults are therein, and what oppressions in the midst thereof. Now what are you doing? He's calling upon these two pagan nations here, heathen nations. Now you assemble here and see, as a witness here, to the condition here that's even worse than you are, and God's going to deal with it. God's going to deal with it. Mountains of Samaria, that would be up about here. Here's Samaria. About here, mountains around it. It's simply calling upon them. Of course, it didn't come literally. He's calling upon them to observe the tumults in Samaria. That is upheavals there, just like in our own country. Look at the tumults here, killings every night somewhere, and in the political turmoil, and in your economic turmoil, and all that. See the tumults here that are taking place, just like it was back there. Right, so now then, so he said. Oppressions here, after tumults and oppressions in the city of Samaria, For they know not to do right, said Jehovah, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces. I know they store up the robbery and violence in the palaces. Therefore, thus said Jehovah, an adversary there shall be even round about the land. Now, Amos never names the adversary. Now, Hosea, who prophesied a few years later, he did name the adversary as Assyria. But Amos never did. He just said an adversary that will be surround you, and he shall bring down thy strength from thee, and thy palaces shall be plundered. Now you fill your palaces with the plunder of the poor. Now then, those palaces are going to be plundered, and that will be taken away by somebody else. So when you store up this plunder, I think that happened back in World War I. Maybe two, one, whichever it was, maybe both of them. The British were, they used children and the poor, they kept them suppressed there, working for them in those factories. Well, the bombing of Hitler, that was like a World War, destroyed all of that. And now that comes sometimes. That's what Habakkuk points out. Habakkuk points out there that when you do these things, then the fire is going to come back on you. You're going to get to Habakkuk pretty soon. Thus saith Jehovah, as a shepherd reacheth out, rescueth out of the mouth of the lion, two legs or a piece of an ear, that's probably two shin bones, just two portions of it, piece of an ear, so shall the children of Israel be rescued to sit in Samaria in the corner of a couch and on the silken cushions of a bed. That indicates the luxury of a luxurious type of living. Right? Now here then, when you're rescuing, here's a lion, it's taking one of your sheep, you try to drive him off, all you have left is just a couple of shin bones and a piece of an ear. Alright, when God gets through with Samaria, that's all that's going to be left there. Just a couple of shin bones and a piece of an ear is all you're going to find in Samaria when I get through with it. Strong language, isn't it? Very strong. Alright, he moves on then. So shall Israel be rescued. Now here comes one more. I want to get to this if I can. Let's see my time. Well, let me just read it anyway. Here, now, this is against the worship and idolatry and all that, and the people. But here you testify against the house of Jacob, saith the Lord Jehovah, the God of hosts. For in the day that I shall visit the transgression of Israel upon him, I'll also visit the altars of Bethel, and the horns of the altar shall be cut off and fall to the ground. And I will smite the winter house and the summer house, and the houses of ivory shall perish, and the great houses shall have an end, saith Jehovah. Ivory inlaid houses. Now they build the houses very extravagantly and have ivory inlaid furniture. Maybe they have ivory inlay in the house there. Right here then is that this is against their wealth and their voluptuous and luxurious living, but also against their worship at Bethel. Now here was Bethel, that's why he's up here prophesying. Here's Bethel up here, that's why they had one of the golden calves. The other one had way up here, Dan, about here. And one at the north, one at the south there. All right, so here now the altar is going to be broken down. Now there's a prophecy back in 1 Kings 13 that deals with this. No, that was a little bit later. That's a little later. And not quite this. But at any rate, this is what's going to happen. So here, that luxurious living. Now here, well, they had a home, for a summer home down here, maybe on the coast or up in the mountains. And here was a winter home. Normally, all that's going to be destroyed. In other words, all of your luxury and all that's going to be brought to an end. I don't know the extent to which God will do that with this country. But when you look at some of these great movie moguls and their homes there and the wealthy there, the way they're doing, the way that they're treated, you just got to have a judgment. Okay, the wickedness. I don't mean it's wrong to have a nice home. Don't mean that. I mean, when you go up all this luxury and all that sort of thing, and robbing the people like this fellow over here, Phoenix, did here, built up his billionaire dollar business by selling stocks and bonds and all that. That kind of a thing has to come to a judgment. And you know, all of this coming out of Washington now, all those senators and representatives, whatever they are, giving those rubber checks up, bouncing back, no money, and getting by with it, and all that stuff that they've been getting by with up there. Riding on the airplanes and charging it to the people all over the country. You just can't have a nation contained to exist on corruption and wickedness. And that's got to come to a judgment. So that's what it says. And God says, he's telling us by his prophets. Nobody said up here. by his prophets. God told us by his prophets there. It's held a secret under his servants, the prophets. He's telling us what it is. His righteous judgments that eventually fall. Well, I hope that this will help us to. It's not pessimism. I'm not pessimistic, all that. I just want to look at this thing as God's revealed it, so we'll know what to look for.